I did transcribe for a bit, but then I was too literal. I'm reading the notes, and if some of the notes didn't make sense with a chord, I would be like banging my head off the wall trying to understand it. But then I got into intention, understand hearing the bigger picture, hearing the phrase. Not every note has to be accurate theoretically, but it's more about feel or where's that note going? Why is there a C sharp on a C major chord? Can't get my head around it. You know what I mean? But it's like, where's it going? You know what I mean? What's it a part of,
Welcome to episode 117 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? Let's hop right in here, huh? Let's hop right in. NAMM 2024. That just happened. I was excited to see what it was going to be like this year. Last year it was a little bit of a shell of itself. But NAMM 24, it was 2024. I was excited to see what it was going to be like. I was into it. It feels like it's getting back into, NAMM as it was. A lot of great stuff out there. I think bases were, base companies were represented much better than last year. Last year, there's like no bass companies out there. This year, Ibanez always has a booth, though. Right? Like, Ibanez always has a booth. this year was very cool. Got to check out some new stuff, stop by the Trickfish booth, talk to my friends over there for a little bit. Did some other meetings around on Friday. Saturday, I didn't end up making it back because of some personal things, but Friday was good. Friday was a good day to be there. I think a little bit more low-key than the Saturday. While I do like some of the manic nature of NAMM, the Friday and Saturday, oof, that can really add up. Saw a lot of friends out there, which was cool. A lot of people I hadn't seen in a while. That's NAMM's always good for that. Overall, I had a great time out there, and it was cool to see what was going on. If you're like me, our social media feeds were full of all kinds of things, of everybody posting their NAMM pictures. So if you did not make it to the show, I'm sure that you caught a glimpse of it somewhere. while I was at NAMM, I did speak to the folks over the International Society of Bassists. We have some exciting things in the works. I'm looking forward to, maybe contributing to their Bassworks magazine. To those that may not be hip to the International Society of Bassists, ISB was formed in 1967 by world-renowned virtuoso Gary Carr. He's a double bassist. Ridiculous. Like, check out Gary Carr if you haven't checked out Gary Carr. ISB is a great, great resource for those who teach, study, play, repair, build, and just overall enjoy the double bass. So, again, if you haven't checked them out before, stop by isbworldoffice.com. All right, in other news, we have some things coming your way from the Bass Shed Academy. Jerry Jamat and myself are finalizing a transcription book. Jerry came over to the studio. Like, it seems like a month ago, but also Christmas seems like it was 5 years ago. Technically, there was a Christmas 5 years ago. Not exactly what I meant, though. You know what I mean? Like, time is feeling weird. This is where we're at. We're like the first week of February. Christmas 2023 feels like it was forever ago. It was just 2 months. So I can't remember when Jerry came to the studio. Anyways, he did come over to the studio. He brought a hard drive with a bunch of tracks he had played on that, are some of his personal favorites. And we listened through those, and Jerry hand-selected these five tunes for a transcription book we're putting together. All the bass lines in the collection cover all levels of playing, from more simple lines for the beginners. There's some stuff for the intermediates. There's some things, for more advanced players. So whatever your level of playing, you can learn from the style of Jerry Jamat with this transcription book. 15 tunes in total. There's more information about the book at thebassshedacademy.org/transcriptions. We are making it available for pre-order, And this is actually a funny little thing about the book. The book is coming out, finally, you know, all in its totalness, March 22nd. I didn't know that March 22nd was actually Jerry's birthday when we decided to do this. So that's kind of cool. It'll be coming out on his birthday. And so for the pre-order, use the promo code BIRTHDAY20 to save 20% on pre-ordering of the Jerry Germont transcription book. Also coming at you from the Bay Shed Academy on Sunday, March 3rd, the Bay Shed Academy is presenting a masterclass with Eric Curtis. Eric Curtis is a touring upright and electric bassist, songwriter, producer, arranger, and composer. The masterclass is fascinating. When I called Eric about this, he brought it up. And I think it's a brilliant topic and definitely something worth covering. And I'm glad he chose to cover this. And he's excited to be talking about how the skills of a bass player and the sensitivities of a bass player and just kind of the things we learn as bass players to, you know, continue to do our job, how those relate to other fields like production and composition and songwriting. So not only just kind of reframing this the same skill set, but also the importance and value of having a diverse skill set, you know, just kind of in the music industry today and how important that is. I think all those things are incredibly important, and I'm so glad he was excited to be talking about that topic. For those in the Los Angeles area, you can attend in person. For those not in the Los Angeles area that would like to attend, you can attend via the live stream on Zoom. All the information is at thebassshedacademy.org/masterclasses. You can also hear Eric on episode 102 of the Bass Shed podcast, so check that out. Lemur Music, everything you need for the double bass. Stop by lemurmusic.com and shop the inventory of basses, bows, rosin, bow cases, sheet music, accessories, etc., etc. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. Lemur Music is also sponsoring a performance by Dr. Matt Hare. Dr. Matt Hare is the principal bassist of the South Coast Symphony and will be performing the works of Sergei Koussevitzky on the Koussevitzky Car Bass. There's more information about the bass and the performance at thebassshedacademy.org and also southcoastsymphony.org. All right. On the episode is Tony Gray. Tony Gray is a multi-instrumentalist, composer, producer, and author, and of course, a ridiculous bassist. Like, if you haven't checked out Tony, you gotta check out Tony. I first got hip to him on the John McLaughlin record. That's what it was. The John McLaughlin record, Industrial Zen. That was the first time I heard Tony, and then I went down the rabbit hole. You know, I checked him out on Hiromi's record, Spiral, which I remember buying that CD. I remember buying that CD at Tower Records in Pasadena. And you remember that? Remember those folks? Remember the CDs? Huh? that came with a DVD, actually. So it was like a live concert DVD and CD. Yeah, so Tony's just been kind of on my radar for a while. Like, I've always just kind of been following him and checking him out. I was really into his 2004 recording, Moving. And it was great to talk to him and hear about the projects he's doing now, the recording projects he's working on. Tony will also talk about his time with Hiromi. He'll talk about his early influences. Tony Gray is related to guitarist John McLaughlin, and he will speak about that. He covers some things that are kind of like the fundamentals to his teaching approach, and even the fundamentals to his practicing approach, which are really interesting. And here it is. Here's my talk with bassist, composer, producer, and author, Tony Gray. How you doing?
I'm good, man. Just running around.
What are you working on today?
I've got a recording session for this guy in India, this guitar player, and he just sent over this crazy fusion track, like mega fast slapping, you know? So I'm like,
I don't think of you as a slap player. Like I've listened to you quite a bit, but I don't. Is that something you got buried in the toolbox that I don't know about?
Well, yeah. Well, when I first started playing, I was really drawn to like Marcus Miller. He was one of the first guys that I ever heard about.
Sure.
My uncle John McLaughlin was saying, "Oh, you got to check this guy out." And I remember I was in the car with him, and we were listening to Wayne Shorter's record, High Life, mm-hmm. Marcus Miller. And I remember I was just sitting in the car with him, and he was saying how amazing he was. And so I was like, "Oh, I've got to get that together," you know. So I shedded it for a few years, man, just like getting the slap sound down. But I never really used it in a live context. I was in a kind of like a gospel band when I was in Boston, and I had to pull it all out. But
okay,
the gigs I got, you know, like with Fuzhinsky and Hiromi and McLaughlin, it was never really required for me to do that.
Right.
And also I was always encouraged to like find my own voice as a musician. So I was kind of always, when I was slapping, they were like, "Oh, you sound like Marcus Miller." And I just gravitated away from it for years and years and years. And then every now and again, I get calls to do stuff that requires those kind of chops, and I just brush up on it. But I've been working on it for years, man.
Yeah. I mean, if you get likened to Marcus with your slap technique, that's a good compliment.
Well,
you know, like, yeah, there's he's one of the best to do that thing, man. It's so killing.
Well, when I said that, I was also conscious. I was like, yeah, well, I'm not, I don't sound like Marcus, but you know, like that kind of style, you know, like that feel, that kind of sound.
Right.
You know? I was always trying to dial in the exact sound, you know, like, and I figured out in that process that you could really get any sound you wanted out of your instrument as long as you had like a strong intention behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we just do things arbitrarily because it's part of the motion that we go through, like practicing and all that. But if you really think about what you want to sound like, how you want to be perceived, all that stuff, then you can find whatever you're looking for on your instrument, really.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. I want to talk to you about you finding your own voice and that idea specifically of being intentional. But before we get there, we'll talk a little bit about your backstory. Like you had I don't know if you'd call it a health scare. You had kind of a traumatic incident in your life right before you started playing.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I was like just growing up in the north of England, and you know, there's not a lot of musicians or music scene there. All right. I certainly didn't grow up around one. And, So I was always kind of fascinated by music. So I got into DJing, like mixing drum and bass stuff and matching beats and all that kind of stuff. So quite often I would have like parties or gatherings at my house where like 20 kids would just pile into my bedroom and would just mix music and
kind
of have a laugh, you know?
Were you throwing raves, Tony? Were you throwing like little bedroom raves?
Yeah.
Is that what was going on?
Every night, man. Like all throughout my childhood, basically, I was just really into that scene. You know, I would go to a lot of raves in like the early 90s when it was like out of control, man, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the Prodigy were like just starting, so we'd go and see them play and there would be a bunch of DJs around them. And yeah, it was pretty awesome. But looking back, it was kind of a little reckless, you know what I mean? Like you weren't exactly looking after our health and thinking about the future, you know what I mean?
Nobody does that when you're that age. You don't.
Yeah, no one does. But, you know, like sometimes you find yourself in like certain circles that's just
pretty destructive.
Yeah, not like good, really good kids, you know, like good hearts, good souls and all that, but just in that world, you know? And I was very skinny and very like frail looking when I was younger. And I remember I overheard a couple of friends say, "Man, somebody asked the time." And this guy was like, "Go and ask that skinny kid over there." And it really impacted me, man. Like just that like way of being talked down about, you know what I mean? And from a friend, you know? So I decided to sell my DJ decks and I bought a bunch of weights.
Okay.
And I started getting into a massive health trip. I got a job at a Chinese restaurant so I could eat the food and get a good like amount of food in every day, and I would train, I would go and take the garbage out and do pull-ups, and
okay,
I just became obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And then I decided to join the army so I could get like some education and direction in my life. So I joined the army, went through all the training and that, and then I signed a declaration to die for my queen and all that. And then I was on a train, and somebody picked me up from the train station. Car broke, like we had a bad car accident, broke my back, got discharged from hospital, and then was just sitting around with my headphones on, just listening to music like Jamiroquai and like Brandon Heavies, and just really kind of immersing myself in the music. And then it was my stepdad that was like, you know, you should play a musical instrument, it'll help your mind. So he brought me home a bass. I remember being quite pissed off at the time because I was kind of in that mindset of like, you can't tell me how to feel better and I'm depressed and all this.
Yeah.
So I was kind of resistant to it, but just over time, I would just pick it up and start playing it. And then it was my dad that was like, oh, you should get some advice off your uncle. And I knew who my uncle was, but I didn't know anything about jazz music. So I didn't know the significance of his career or who he was or anything like that.
Now, is McLaughlin on your dad's side, an uncle, or on your mother's side?
He was married to my dad's sister.
Okay.
So I grew up with his daughters, and like the whole that part of the family was very close growing up. But so he called me and he was like, hey, I heard you want to play music and I'm playing in Scotland. And he was playing with Dennis Chambers and Joey DeFrancisco, the organ trio. So I went to Scotland to see them play. Had no idea what I was listening to, but I got to meet the guy, sit on the bus with him and all that. And then I went into his hotel room and he was like, hey, you want to play music? You got to go to America. And I was like, okay, cool. And then like literally like about 6-7 months later, or maybe 8 months later, I was on my way to Berkeley.
Okay.
I'd learned some Charlie Parker solo and played it as my audition. But I think they thought I was improvising. So I didn't know what improvising was.
Yeah,
so I just learned the solo and developed this way of playing technically, like from a very, I think because my first mentor was John McLaughlin, you know, so I was just focused on him and he's, because he's so fast and fluent that I think I was drawn to kind of that way of playing naturally and not really thinking about the bass as a bass or understanding the function of it or anything like that. So yeah, so I got put into a high ensemble, then quickly realized that I was terrible. So I got bumped down to the worst ensemble. And then it was from there that I was like, okay, I got to get it together, you know?
With terrible in the sense of like you hadn't spent time reading or like your theory knowledge or just like your understanding of the bass as a foundational instrument first. Like all those things weren't as developed as your technique?
Well, I could read because that's all I had. I went to a music store in my hometown. And at that time, there was not a great selection of things to learn or play with. So I picked up a couple of bass books, didn't really understand them. I was just looking at them literally, like looking at the notes and playing the notes and playing along with a thing, with the tracks or whatever, the CD or whatever it was, probably a tape at that time. But it was like, like, okay, rock feel, dong, 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 dong. So I was able to kind of just learn that stuff fairly quickly. And then I saw another book that was in bass clef, and it was the Charlie Parker Omni book. And I just grabbed it and bought it. I had no idea who he was. The internet wasn't around. Didn't have any CDs.
That didn't seem intimidating to you to like open up a book that says rock feel and it's just a bunch of eighth notes on an E string. And then you open up, you know, like a Parker solo on rhythm changes or something. And it's like, huh, that's a much more complicated read.
Well, it was just what was around, you know, it's just what I grabbed. Okay. I remember there was some piano music that my mom had that I grabbed and tried to read, but I could only read the bass part of it. So I was looking for something that would stimulate me because I was injured at the time. You know, I was very ill, like in the mind and in the body. So I was literally just sitting around and just having something that was difficult or complicated was kind of a good challenge for me. It helped put me in the mind space. And I quickly became like, I didn't understand theory at all, but I understood how to read. And from there, I just learned how to navigate my way around.
Okay.
So it was But I was practicing at that time. I was like obsessed. So it was like 12 hours a day, every day. Yeah.
Right.
For like months and months and months and months.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're injured and you can't go be active at all, like what else are you going to do?
Nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think most of us caught that bug early on where it's just like you latch onto this thing and you're just obsessed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think music facilitated your recovery mentally and physically?
Well, it facilitated my physical recovery because, and mental in a sense too, because like I said, I become very obsessed with whatever I'm working on. I'm very like focused on whatever I want to do. So at that time, it was like just passing the days away, and I wasn't focused so much on feeling sorry for myself. I kind of felt like I had a purpose or a direction. And then when I had the opportunity to go to America, I had no idea what Berkeley was. So it in one sense, it healed me. And then the other sense, it brought a massive amount of anxiety because I never really visioned or visualized myself being a professional musician. It was literally just something to do. Just like I was never visualizing being a DJ. It was just something to do. And I enjoyed it. So I just kept doing it, like playing soccer or football when I was a kid.
Right.
So it was like that. And then all of a sudden I'm like there, which is exciting. But a lot of anxiety came with just being around people who were amazing and me really feeling out of depth, but also feeling privileged that somebody like famous musician helped me kind of get there. And I think there was a lot of expectation. And so if anyone knew that I was related and getting helped with John, then they would be like, oh, do you want to play? Hey, let's play. And I was just like, couldn't hang, you know what I mean?
Right. Do you feel like that was ever, did people ever give you a hard time because your uncle has had a, you know, infamous, legendary international career? We're like, he's here because his uncle, blah, blah, blah. And then like you got personally discarded, or they wanted to be around you because of your association and relationship with John McLaughlin?
Yeah, they wanted me around me for the association because there's this whole myth like, oh, you know such and such, well, you're going to hook me up and I'm going to be successful.
Right. Yeah. I'm gonna get on the McLaughlin gig if I hang out and get lunch with Tony.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, but obviously it doesn't, like there's not really such a thing as nepotism on that level, you know what I mean? It's like, if you can't do it, you can't do it, man. And he's the first to always tell me, are you ready? Oh, I don't know, then you're not ready. When you're ready, you know you're ready, and you don't even question it, you just do it. So that was always his words to me. So I was always like, okay, I don't feel ready. If I was in that situation, could I hang? Hell no. Okay, keep going. But I didn't necessarily get any feedback directly to my face. I think one kid, some drummer, wanted to play Odd Time Signatures, so he wanted to play with me, and I didn't know how to play in 4/4, never mind. As soon as someone did it, I was lost, you know what I mean? So and I remember him overhearing him say, wow, I thought you were John McLaughlin's nephew, I thought you should be good at this stuff. I overheard him say something like that. So there was some people who were kind of being a bit of haters. But to be honest, that makes me want to succeed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I just try even harder, just really isolate the things that I think I need to know to get me to the next level. And I was really fortunate to have a couple of mentors at Berkeley. I had a few, actually, like 3 or 4 mentors that just literally couldn't care less who I was or where I was from or what associations I had, just really were good teachers and wanted to help.
That's great.
Beyond the classroom, you know what I mean?
Great. That's great. I'm fascinated by this because I went through, I was in a car accident and had, 4 brain hemorrhages or something, and I was in a coma, and doc said I'd be a vegetable and stuff. So I went through kind of a gnarly medical thing too. And I remember when I got out of the hospital, I heard music differently. Did you experience that when you came out and were healing physically?
Yeah.
Like your body's still trying to figure itself out, and like, but music, you heard things you never heard before, and this whole other world opened up. Did you experience that?
100%. Like I would, everything had much more meaning and depth to me. I don't know if it was because you go through a near-death experience that you start to pay more attention to things, or become more emotional to things, or your energy changes. But it just reminds me. Are you familiar with Oliver Sacks?
No.
He did some studies on the brain and traumatic injuries, and then the impact of music.
Oh, interesting. I'm going to look this up right now. Oliver Sacks.
Sacks, S-A-K-S.
Okay, Oliver Sacks.
You see him?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, a British neurologist.
And so he did some studies. Man, he's like the most phenomenal human man. He did studies with people who had, some guy got struck by lightning, right? Okay. And then he became obsessed with music, and it dominated his entire life. He became into classical music and would practice all day and night, and just became, he never had that skill before, you know?
Yeah.
But it kind of ruined his life in a way, because he ended up getting divorced and he just became too into it, you know?
Right. That's all that mattered to him, right?
Some lady had a brain hemorrhage and then became obsessed with piano playing, but her style of music completely changed. Like her taste in music, the thing she hated the most, she was drawn to and loved the most. Mm. It became prolific. And then there was this other patient that he did a case study on, was a guy with Alzheimer's. He couldn't speak to the nurses, couldn't address anybody, couldn't talk, couldn't eat properly, couldn't respond to simple commands or questions. And they came in with a pair of headphones and put it on him, and he started singing along because he recognized the music, like it was like old 20s, 30s jazz music. Okay. So he was singing along the lyrics, and he was smiling and laughing and tapping his foot and his hand and all that. And then he took his headphones off, and they were like, "What's your name?" He was like, "Blah, blah, 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 blah. And who's your wife?" And blah, blah, blah. And he was coherent. Yeah, man. So it's music crazy. Is wild, man.
yeah, agreed. Agreed. All right, so where are we at in the timeline? You're healing up. You're practicing all the time. What were some of the first gigs that you start going to do after you're at Berklee? You're getting it together. When do you start performing, and what are those gigs?
Well, a couple of the ensembles. I was in this Motown ensemble, and the teacher was this professor called Larry Watson. He's like, honestly, ridiculous, man. Like,
nice.
The people who went through his band, like Billy Keelson, Hiromi, Ollie Rockberg, Big Yuki, Yohei Nakamura from Stevie Wonder's band.
Uh-huh.
Like, we were all in the same band, man.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Hold on. That band was playing Motown? Because you can name any one of those people, and I don't think of them as a... Well, I heard Yohei out here. Yohei sounds good on everything.
He's phenomenal, dude. But he would just grab... So you wanted to have like diversity. Billy Keelson was before me, but it was somebody who we always referenced to, you know, like, "Hey, Billy Keelson is," and "Hey, check out Billy Keelson." So all the drummers were like, he got all the drummers doing our homework and stuff. And this Japanese drummer, Kira Nakamura, who plays a lot with Big Yuki, man, played with Hiromi as well. Like, he just brought like Ollie Rockberger, and he just brought like stuff out of you that was beyond the notes written on the paper.
Yeah.
You know, he would like, he would be like, "Yo, like, how you can feel music and play like that?" He's like, because he would be awkwardly dancing and playing, and he's like, "You must be a genius to move like that and play like that." They're not connected, man. And so he would always be like, "You need to go dancing lessons and this and that." And he told me, he's like, "You know," he said, "I don't know what notes you're playing that are right or wrong, but I know it doesn't feel right."
Mm.
So you need to go and listen to Donny Hathaway, and you need to go listen to this Aretha Franklin CD, and you need to go listen to this Anita Baker CD, and come back next week with a different output.
But how much exposure had you had to soul music? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, Brand New Heavies, because you mentioned them earlier. They got that vibe, like that soul funk vibe.
Yeah.
It's a UK band. I love that band, actually. But like, have you checked
out? I didn't marry the two at that time, though.
Okay.
I was so like, Motown. Okay, Motown. So I bought the Shadows of Motown book, and that was like my Bible for that stuff. But the Brand New Heavies, I kind of let that part of my life. They weren't even in my consideration.
Yeah, there's like an association there that it stayed over here.
It stayed over there, but now I'm like, oh wow, yeah, Zendaya, and Stuart Zendaya, like killer, you know? And
Yeah.
So now it all come first circle, and I understand music now, so I can kind of go, oh, that's the drum and bass stuff coming out, and I'm playing. Okay, cool.
Right.
No really exposure as far as my understanding was. So I would just dive into that world and just go into a mode of just transcribing day and night, mm-hmm. like day and night, man.
That's how you get it together. It's just go that way. So you got into all the Motown stuff, Stevie. Did you get into more modern R&B, Michael Jackson, stuff like that? Or did you keep it just in the older Motown era?
Yeah, well, a lot of us who were in that band had like a little side gig. Like there was a singer who was a little further on in Berkeley. Like she was in her last year or something, and she was looking for a band to play in this bar once a week. So we started doing that, and then we would do like funk covers. It was like that, man. It was just like a crowd of us would just go and hang and play these gigs. But I was still limited in my knowledge of really the bass. You know, I still was like very novice, you know. But I was lucky enough to audition for this pop band who came through Berkeley. It was my... Actually, I'm jumping ahead. You know, like, I went to Berkeley for a year and dropped out.
I mean, I think that's pretty typical.
Yeah, well, I got a gig my first year there because I didn't know how to really play at all. I wasn't exposed to the Motown stuff yet, and I was just trying to figure out what the instrument was. But I connected with a Scottish guy who's a drummer, and there was an audition. Some record label came to Berkeley to do an audition for drummers and bass players to join this pop band and go on a like world tour. Uh-huh. I ended up auditioning, and because of my connection with a drummer, and he was a character, they really liked him and wanted him, and he really wanted me for his comfort zone.
Yeah.
So I ended up with that gig, and that gig took me to Asia. I was in Asia for a couple of years, like touring and recording, and we had like MTV and Top 10 Hits and all that stuff. Killer. And it was just so random because I learned actually how to play bass. The gig itself was very easy, just like quarter notes, eighth notes, nothing flashy, funky. It was just straight up pop. And so that's where I learned how to play bass. And then when that gig ended, I went back to Berkeley and then met Ollie and Hiromi, and then I was schooled in that world. And then,
So there was what happened to that artist that you or that band? Are they still out doing stuff?
No, well, it was kind of a disaster in a way, man. the label was a new label. And it was a startup label by this mogul, Terry Ellis, who was the guy who discovered Pat Benatar, Blondie, Huey Lewis in the News, Jethro Tull, Billy Idol. Like, he was like a dude. He owned Chrysalis Records. And
so he was starting a new label?
Starting a new label to test, like, the Asian market or whatever they were doing. So they wanted a boy band, because at that time it was like boy band mania, you know?
Yeah.
So he wanted a band that could play music and look good. And I'm not saying I look good, but...
but he thought you did, and you got...
No, he didn't. He didn't at the time. They didn't want me at all, actually. It was the drummer who really persuaded him, and he asked me to do a bunch of stuff, like go tanning. I had an eyebrow ring. He's like, take the eyebrow ring out. I had shaven head. He's like, grow your hair. Take that eyebrow ring out. Sort yourself out.
So all this just kind of like reeks of late 90s. Is that what that era is? That's a shaved head eyebrow ring era.
I was a skateboarder. I was into skateboarding. Yeah. So, and I wasn't expecting to join the gig, and I didn't really want to necessarily do the audition. I just got to America.
Right.
And my family were really pissed off at me for actually taking the gig once it was offered to me.
Because you went there for school and not to leave America.
Yeah, exactly. I left America and give up my visa and just split. and went to Singapore, man, and then was like didn't come home for like 2.5, 3 years.
Wow.
And we were playing like thousands, tens of thousands of people, man. We did like two
Man.
road shows in India and Singapore and
That's killer, man.
Thailand and Philippines and
Yeah.
Indonesia. Yeah, it was fun, man. And but that band, yeah, so we were kind of, I don't want to get into the details of it, but the lead singer wasn't happy that we were in the band because he thought we had like, we were like, oh, we're jazz musicians, we're better than this. I wasn't at all. I was really terrible, as I was saying, and I was making a lot of mistakes. And he was always throwing the comments, hey, you went to Berkeley, I thought you could play. I was making horrific mistakes, easy stuff, man, and
Yeah.
getting really upset with me and flicking picks at me and shit. And anyway, the gig just kind of ended. The guitar player.
How did you respond to that? Like you mentioned that, you know, when people would talk negatively or something, that was always fuel for you to come back stronger and better. So when this singer or band leader was saying this stuff, did you like, all right, next gig I'm gonna crush it? He's never gonna have the chance to say that again. Like, watch me, dude. Just watch me. I'm gonna crush this.
Yeah, totally, man. I just
Yeah.
like, I'm gonna crush out, dude. So I would like live like in the hotels. I would just be practicing all night and all morning. And we
Yeah.
like the gig started off like we did all the promo. We did a couple of videos for MTV and a couple of we did the recording, which I wasn't on. It was a guy from Chicago who was on the recording,
Okay.
Jason Jeff.
Who is
Yeah,
it?
Jason Sheff, I think it is.
Okay.
He was doing all the background vocals and the bass playing, and I was kind of having to learn them parts and pretend I was singing the backing parts, you know? So I was, they were literally just looking for musicians who, so they were like, okay, Berkeley, there must be great musicians there. Let's go to Berkeley and do auditions.
Sure.
Little did they know that I'm like totally in at the deep end.
Yeah.
And like, so. It was very stressful, dude. I went the SIR studios in New York and did a massive audition in this huge stadium stage with this guy staring at me, looking at me, going, nah, he's not looking right and this and that. And then literally from there it was like, okay, he's in. And it was all system go, you know. So we moved to a place near Philadelphia, rehearsed with a band for a few months, and then me and the drummer went to Singapore. And what they did was, as they were getting their marketing together, like we were doing radio interviews and
Sure.
like pre-record, like to be used later, like photo shoots, interviews, magazines, all this stuff. But we actually had a gig at a Sheraton hotel in Bangkok for like 16 weeks
Okay.
on the sly, just like on the quiet, just
Yeah,
in there, right? Playing like three sets a night. With like a Sunday off or maybe, so it's like 6 nights a week, like gigging all night. So I would just spend that whole time just practicing in the hotel room and like doing a gig at night, getting up in the morning, practicing crazy, like just on cycle for them six
that'll get
weeks.
your chops together quick.
Also playing those three sets a night, playing like top 40 stuff that he wouldn't obviously allow music on stage. So I would have to just shred it and shed it all day. Chumbawamba, you know what I mean? And
I forgot about that band.
and like Pink Floyd stuff and like Eric Clapton, like so I just
Sure.
got good at memorizing stuff quickly, but obviously I was making mistakes because as soon as I would try and be flashy or fancy, I would get lost and not have a perspective of where I was. So I was like memorized, not knowing chords, but just memorizing bass lines. And yeah, man. And then also the band. The label wanted us to be diverse, so sometimes it would make me the lead singer, even
Oh
though I
wow.
couldn't sing and I didn't want to sing. But they were
Yeah,
like, sing, and we're going to film you, and we're going to watch it and study it, and this, and we're going to do it every day.
jeez.
So I would have to pick a tune and go out and sing. And the bass player, the drummer would come and play bass, the lead singer would play drums, the piano player played trumpet. And it was just like that. We just rotated and just learned how to play a couple of tunes on different instruments.
Oh
But because I was pretty bad at everything, they were just like, you just gotta sing, you know what I mean? So that was it, man. That was my school. And then and I think that was the biggest lesson that I ever had, because once I came back to Berkeley, I understood the role of the bass was easy, able to understand the Motown stuff and get into it, be able to take criticism and find a way of like making it better and finding my people and just a good crew of guys like Ollie or Hiromi, or they became like my best friends, you know?
We'll be back right after this.
All right, folks, get heard on the Bay Shed podcast. I am opening up the middle of the show to talk about what you all are up to. Stop by thebayshed.com, click on Get Featured, and let me know what news you'd like me to share. If it's upcoming gigs, if it's your website, if it's your social media handles, if it is your YouTube page, whatever it is, stop by thebayshed.com, click on Get Featured, and exactly that, Get Featured on the Bay Shed podcast. All right, the features are brought to you by the International Society of Bassists. Stop by isbworldoffice.com to check out the latest news in the double bass community. For those who checked out the last episode, John Pena hit me up this week and let me know that part two of Life, Legacy, and Music will be out soon. Life, Legacy, and Music is a three-album project that encapsulates and highlights aspects of his career, his life, his faith, all of it through music. Stop by johnpenyamusic.bandcamp.com for more information. Again, on Sunday, March 3rd, the Bay Shed Academy is proud to present a masterclass by Eric Curtis. Eric Curtis is a touring upright and electric bassist, songwriter, producer, arranger, and composer. Eric will discuss the importance and value of having a diverse skill set and how the sensibilities of a bass player translate into some of these other fields like songwriting and music production and composition. Again, this has been brought to you by International Society of Bassists.
Excellent, sir.
So you come back to Berkeley, you graduate this time, you get the Outstanding Performer Award. So you come back way stronger than you left.
Yeah.
After you graduate, what are you doing? Are you gigging around Berkeley? Around the time you go out with Hiromi?
Yeah, not straight away. Like, so after I graduated, I had like a grace period for a year.
Okay. Then
So I was just kind of still practicing, just being around the area, you know. Like I graduated a little bit before, like my friends, like they were like still had a couple of years to go. So I was just kind of there, and then I got an O-1 visa. The guy, Larry Watson, helped. I was in a band with him. We'd play different universities around the like state, like New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, just kind of playing different universities and colleges, and he would demonstrate his teaching and ensemble teaching, and we were just like the guys that he would be like critiquing like live, you know, like everyone stop, bass, funk, let's go. And I would be like and he would be like, oh, my brother ain't that funky, but we're gonna work on it. He kind of expose us, but like all of us, you know.
Yeah.
He would find all our weaknesses and like just put us on the spot and then encourage us and get in our face and embarrass us in a way, but in a sense that he knew where he could go with us. Like he was like, okay, I'm going to push these guys. I'm going to be one of them. I'm going to like have fun with them and then rip them apart and this and that and just expose them and this. And it was amazing. So I got an O-1 visa and stuck around for a year with him. Then I started getting gigs with Dave Fuzinski.
Mm-hmm.
I met Dave. I was gigging with Kenwood Denard as well. Like he was one of my big mentors. I went in and jammed with him. I just knocked on his door like every day, man. Like, hey, can I play? Hey, can I play? Can I play? And one time, Lionel Luwuke, the guitar player, he was there and he was like, hey, let's play. So we started doing this trio thing behind the scenes, just jamming, you know? And he would always say to me, look, you're overplaying, you're this, you're that, you're not understanding the fundamentals and you need to listen to James Brown. So then I obviously went with my tail between my legs and bought every James Brown record and transcribed them. And then I went back to his office and played them and ended up getting a gig with him. And then through him, I met Dave Fuzinski. And then Dave started teaching out of my apartment because he needed a place to teach. And we had a couple of mutual friends. And they were like, hey, Tony won't mind. Go teach at his place. So he would just teach in my apartment. And sometimes he would be like, hey, do you want to just play along? For me and the student, and I would just play bass and accompany them, and then I got a good friend Fuse, and then he took me and Akira on the road, and then from there, Hiromi wanted to do stuff.
Cool, killer man. Here we are. To go back to the beginning of the conversation, you talked a lot about, you know, people that inspired you to focus and take a deeper look at different aspects of music, whether it was old soul or funk or something, or get in touch with the roots of American music. How do you incorporate that into teaching students to find their voice?
Yeah, it's tricky because sometimes theory, like I'm a theory nut, I love theory, but sometimes I would get too caught up in the academic side of things that things would start to sound a little stiff or forced, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think learning theory is important, but I think it's so important to learn and immediately be creative with whatever you've got. So if you, like in me looking back, for me just grew, like I watched the Abe Laboreal thing and he was like just grooving on one note. He didn't even care how the note was functioning, but he was just playing along with the track and just enjoying it. So I think it's like now I actually decided when I started doing my academy thing, I decided, which I've gone to an even more extreme now, but I haven't released anything yet. But I was like, okay, I'm going to unlearn my instrument and I'm going to relearn it like from scratch. And I'm going to try to apply, you know, I've heard this so many times people say, I wish that was available when I was starting. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start from the beginning. And I'm going to do all the things that I wish I would have done from now, but this time I'm going to document it. I'm going to figure out what was helpful, what was not helpful, what created the light bulb, what I struggled with, what I thought I knew, but I didn't really know, which I'm still discovering today. And so now when I get a student, I just try to, first of all, figure out or ask them to be like, what do you want? You know, like for me,
I think
that's
important.
I wanted to sound like Matthew Garrison. I wanted to sound like Gary Willis. You know what I mean? So I would. What did they know? You know what I mean? Like what?
Right.
Okay, he's playing Inner Urge. Okay. Like let's try and play. Oh shit! I can't play that. I just kind of reverse engineer. Okay, I need to understand what the chords are. I need to understand what the scales are. Now I need to transcribe him and figure out what he did and try. You know, I did transcribe for a bit, but then I was too literal. You know, I'm reading the notes, and if some of the notes didn't make sense with a chord, I would be like banging my head off the wall trying to understand it. But then I got into intention, you know, understand hearing the bigger picture, hearing the phrase. Not every note has to be accurate theoretically, but it's more about feel or where's that note going, you know? Why is there a C sharp on a C major chord? Can't get my head around it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, where's it going? You know what I mean? What's it a part of, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. So now it's like, I just try to get students to create with whatever they want to do, you know?
Yeah. So you start with the creativity aspect of it and have them generate something. And so what kinds of things are there? Do you have them just play anything that they feel all over the instrument, even though they might not even understand the fretboard yet? Or are you trying to lock them in like, okay, let's play free, you know, only using the notes of a whatever G flat minor scale or something, but like stay, you know, express yourself freely, but within that structure.
Yeah. Within parameters, certain parameters. Yeah. So for example, if you're going to play a groove and you only know what one note is, then just let's groove on one note. Try to identify what the kick drum's doing. Try to like tap it out. Try to mimic it on the bass. Now try to play in between it and how does it feel? You don't always have to be on the bass drum. You can counter it, you know, like it depends. So is the drums busy? Do you need to be less busy? Is there a fill there? Do you need to leave space? Like just understanding like the energy of music.
Right.
Like, strong beat, weak beat, like why do drummers do fills in certain places all the time, or why is there a bass fill in this particular area every time? It's to do with the energy, you know, hearing the cycle of the form or the beat or whatever it is. So then you could do that, but then you could say, okay, you look at a tune like Autumn Leaves and you're like, okay, it looks doable, but okay, you can pretty much get away in one scale playing over the whole thing, but then there's a tendency to just wail, you know?
Yeah.
But like, okay, so now let's think like phrases, like pentatonic, like, okay, like, even though you don't necessarily understand the theory behind it all, like, take it from me, you can play an E minor pentatonic or a blues, E blues scale over that entire form. Right. Not all of the notes will line up perfectly, but it becomes about intention. Okay, so hear your phrase. Do 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 do. Like, you know, finding the places where these phrases work within the form and starting to feel the energy and then starting to build the confidence of like, okay, so scales are important, but phrasing is probably more important. So start with simple fragments and just try to create musical phrases, which in turn gives you confidence to then try other things simultaneously that might be a little bit more challenging. It's going to unlock other aspects like chord tones. Okay, like Mike Stern, you hear Mike Stern play on that tune and he demonstrates using only chord tones. It sounds like a killer bebop solo, you know?
Right.
So now I would start doing things like that. Oh, I'm only going to use chord tones, and then start to understand the relationship between a minor seven and a dominant chord. Like, okay, that flat seven is resolving to the third, etc. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, look for different resolution points between the changes and all that stuff.
Yeah, the third resolving to the root. Yeah. So when you're soloing, you, by chance, sometimes you just fall on those things, but I would start composing solos only using chord tones, or try exercises only using chord tones. And just through time and awareness, then you start getting comfortable with those guy tones, and then they become a part of your natural playing. And then like, so things like that, man, just like, but just identifying things that help you and then just making systems out of them. So, okay, you've got a beginning and you've got an end, you know, the speed is not the goal, but just conceptually, okay, let's go at 60 beats per minute up to like 140 beats per minute, 160 beats per minute. And then when you're there, and you're comfortable, move on to the next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I just wrote a blueprint of like all the things that I wanted to do personally. Like, okay, I want to be good at walking bass lines. I want to be good at slapping. I want to, because you never know, man. You never know who's listening, and you never know like what opportunities are going to come out of that. And sometimes you have to take an opportunity that is not necessarily your biggest dream, but it will lead to that. Because the music industry is tight.
It's so small, right. Well, a lot of things you were talking about with understanding the energy of where things are going and stuff, that's a very, what's the word I'm looking for? That's intuitive approach. Now, if you have a private student or you're teaching a master class or something, and maybe the student doesn't have this kind of intuition. Now, I do think on some level we all do. To varying degrees. I think some people are more intuitive than others. But how do you talk about intuition? Because you're right, you know, you can just feel where things are going, and you can, that leads us and dictates how we can support where the music is going. If you're hearing a soloist or singer go in a certain direction, we know how to support them to get there. That's all intuitive. If you encounter a student that doesn't have that intuition, how do you go about speaking to them?
Well, just simple exercises, you know, like sometimes, like you say, we all have intuition. It's just all about whether or not we feel confident enough to allow us to accept our intuition, you know, so sometimes we can psych ourselves out and go, I can't do that. Or like I have a 2-year-old, you know, they try to put a puzzle piece in the thing. It doesn't fit. Their first reaction is to be like, no,
right.
I'm not doing rip it apart, throw it, like, you know what I mean? But sometimes it's just like, take your time and try to guide them and all that. But so we psych ourselves out of a lot of things that we are very capable of doing. We've listened to music our whole life. It's part of us. We really do understand it, man. As soon as we pick up a physical object and then we're drawn to the physical limitations that we have, then we could become stuck in our mind and not able to see what we're capable of if we just systemize it. And so what I would do is like, I would just put on a track and you know, just like, okay, count, okay. And like hear the cycle of 4K, you hear the one there and you hear the cycle, you hear the drum fill, you hear this intention, or hearing scales. Like, so for example, like I first learned a major scale and it was like, da, 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 da. Okay, cool. I can use that over major chords for soloing. All right, awesome. Okay, da, 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 2-4-1-2-4-1-3-4. Okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah, yeah. Got it.
Okay, now I'm going to do F major. Da, 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 da,
yeah.
Da, da. Oh, I'm nailing this, and then you see a major chord. Like,
yeah.
But so here's the intuitive part. Like, it's intuitive to do that, right? Because we're taught that that scale fits over that chord, and that's what we got. And then the minor chord and the minor scale does that for the minor chord. Right. And we might be exposed to a Mixolydian scale, and that's for dominant chords. And yeah, man, check it out. It's easy, man. Like, got it. But when I learned, the intention of notes, like do 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 do, like talk about strong beat, weak beat, right? So do da da do da do da. All the chord tones are on downbeats, so our ears are, oh, we're not listening to a scale, we're listening to a chord,
right?
So when we hear a scale, the chord tones are jumping out because they're on strong beats. So the non-chord tones are almost arbitrary, you know what I mean? We're not hearing. It is a melodic device, which is hearing the whole thing as a device.
Right.
But confused about how the notes are actually creating that melody within a scale. So it was like when I was learning the John Coltrane solo for Giant Steps, I was like, okay, 1, 2, what was it? Do, do, da, da, 1, 2, 3, 5, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, learn them permutations, 1, 2, 3, 5. And I was learning them permutations, and then I all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm not hearing 1, 2, 3, 5. I'm hearing 1 going to 3, 5. Do do
right.
Da,
okay. Right. You weren't hearing the non-chord tone.
Yeah, it's a passing tone. You know, it's like, yeah. It's like almost like it's a boat taking you from island to island.
Right. Right.
So when you can read do do da do da da da.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're only hearing where you get to, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Them non-scale tones could be chromatic notes, there could be ghost notes, there could be anything really.
Sure.
As long as you end up where you're getting to. And then so that realization of like, do do da do da, or do da do da do da, do do da do do da do, like just hearing that energy of like a scale and how you could build melodies from it was like life-changing for me and my musicality, because now I really understood that everything sounds good for a specific reason. Your heart's warmed because of like certain movements in harmony, you know, like the minor chord makes you feel sad. I started to connect with how things made me feel, and tried to hear when I was, instead of transcribing, I would just listen and try to hear the phrases and try to hear the intention, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know,
they like the intention of a chord, because I mean, if we're talking about now, I think this is fascinating, and I agree with all of it. But if you take like a normal chord progression, whatever we're talking about, jazz, so 2-5-1, there's a cadence there that has tension and release, and a lot of modern instrumental improvised music, the chord progressions of the harmony are more sequential and not, you know, all tonal based. Like, they're not always leading back to one. It's just these chords that are kind of impressionistic. They create a sequence. And so if you have a strong, you know, a dense chord, you know, let's say an E flat 7, you know, major 7, sharp 5. You know, like, that has a very specific mood to it, the major 7, sharp 5 chord. Yep. Now, are you playing the intention of where it's going, or kind of the static impression of how the chord feels, or both?
Both. First thing is, for me, because it's so subjective. Mm-hmm. So first thing for me, it's like, if I see the chord, I want to understand what that chord is doing just by itself. So if we were just going to play E flat, major 7, sharp 5 all day,
yeah,
then I really want to understand what I can get away with.
Yeah.
Okay, what are the chord tones? E flat, G, B, and D, right?
Mm.
And then what what's the mode, what's the parent mode. So for me, I'm thinking third mode of melodic minor.
Sure.
So then I'm going to figure out what are the non-chord tones. Are they a whole step above the chord tones? Like the F is a whole step above the root, so it's going to sound nice in the chord.
Right.
The B, now what is it? What's my other non-chord tone? C? No, what is it? So it would be E, F, G, A, right? Mm-hmm. A is...
The sharp 11. I mean, it's kind of a chord tone if you...
Okay, so yeah, sharp 11 sounds good because it's a whole step above the third.
Right.
And then the C is a 13. Half step above the B.
Right, there's going to be a rub there, yeah.
Play that chord and then isolate that C, it sounds bad.
Yeah.
Right? If you use that C as a passing tone, it sounds good.
Sure.
So it's all about energy, like what can I get away with? What can I... Like if you're playing super fast, you don't hear it.
No, you
But
won't.
If you stopped on that C... You'd be like, oh, rough.
Yeah.
Right. So,
right.
So I go through a process with every single chord.
Okay.
Like every chord and how it functions, like one major Ionian, only Ionian. I'm going to learn it over my whole range of the instrument. I'm going to learn it one octave, two octaves, learn the chord tones. I'm going to practice with a drone so I can hear it, color it, put on a groove slowly, try to avoid that F on a strong note.
Mm-hmm.
On a strong beat and just weave and try to make music and play off chord tones and play off different degrees, start phrases from other chord tones, end phrases on chord tones to see the resolution, end on like this 13 and see that it's like, oh, it's a viewpoint, it sounds beautiful, but if I bring it back to the G, it sounds home. If I bring it back to the B, it sounds home, but open, more beautiful. So it's understanding the relationship of every note individually and every note collectively.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do that for the E-flat major 7 sharp 5. Like I would just get into it and go through my process. But then the next thing is, okay, where's it going? How's it functioning in this? Okay, so if it's going, I don't know, to a whatever chord, like a G minor 7. So if I'm on a note B, then I know that if I go up a half step, it's going to be tension 11 on G minor. It sounds beautiful. Or if I go back a half step, it's going to land on the flat third degree, which is a chord tone. So I'm looking for like...
Still that guide tone kind of sequence through the
changes.
Always
looking for guide tones. That came from learning the chord tones and just seeing that strong movement between chords. So I'm always trying to find... ways. So if for example, I was practicing that and I was having a hard time, like if I was sight reading it on a gig and I was like, that was a bit of a rough change. So maybe I'll just isolate those two chords and practice linear, you know, playing through the chord.
Sure.
And then we'll just practice soloing and blah, blah, blah. And practicing with different rates. So four bars of that, four bars of that. Okay. Two bars of that, two bars of that. One
right,
bar
making
of that,
it really
that.
Quick. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And just trying to be comfortable no matter what the change is. Is it diatonic to that chord? Are they connected? Where's that going next? Okay, can I get away with a pentatonic riff for a few bars because the chords are all intertwined?
Sure.
So it's all about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean...
It's a whole to-do, man.
Yes. Yes, it is a whole to-do. Do you have any projects coming up that... you just released a record, right? The duo record? Or you're about to? Did I read that correctly?
I'm in a pickle, man. I've got 5 CDs completely finished, right? I just went on a massive creative spurt. So I've got a record with Mark Juliana, Mike Stern, and Roman Colleen, and John Shannon, and Minu Sinelu, and some great Naveen Kumar, great Indian flute player. So Max ZT. So I've got this record with all these guys, Ryan Kavanagh on banjo, and Obed Calvez on a track. So I've got all these great musicians on this record that I've had got finished. And then I stumbled in an opportunity with Bob James, you know, Bob
mm-hmm.
James.
Yeah.
I was dialoguing with him. He reached out and said, hey, maybe we could make some music together. So I went, he invited me to his home. I went to his house and we started working on just random music, jamming, coming up with ideas for composition, and then stayed there for a few days, came back, made a whole entire record with him.
Yeah,
you know, like contributed a bunch of tunes that I did, and then made this record. So now I've got that record finished as well. And then I was like, okay, how can I raise my social media profile so I can get a good audience for this, because it's what an honor to have these guys. I don't want to just put it out and then be, because I disappeared for a long time from doing stuff, to take a break and work behind the scenes on these books and stuff, you know.
Is this because your last record, 2013, was your last record?
Couldn't tell you, mate.
Yeah.
It seemed like a long time ago. It was like the record with John McLaughlin and...
I think that's the one. I was actually checking that out a couple of days ago, you know, in kind of in preparation for our talk. I think it was 2013. So, like, around that time, you take time off to get into the books, doing whatever gigs you're doing. And...
Well, I was touring quite a lot of the time.
Okay.
And... I left New York and moved somewhere else. So I was dealing with that. I was building the academy at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of things going on. I was gigging with a lot of different bands and recording with a lot of different bands. So life just became kind of mental for me. And I was more focused on other people's music than I was necessarily on my own. But anyway, I got back into it. And now, because I've taken some time out, I've got to kind of reintroduce myself a little bit. So I've got these records and I'm just trying to figure out which order I've also got a record, like a jazz standards record, that's just me alone. It's like a bass orchestra kind of thing. Sometimes it's like 10 bass tracks, but it's all very melodic and pretty, like all standards and stuff like that. So I've got that one finished that I was just doing for fun, really. And then I got into playing with Ian Masiak on drums, the Ian Hits drums guy. But we've been doing some duo stuff, and that was getting quite a buzz, and we were actually touring a little bit, and I was doing some masterclasses around. And so we've been working on something as well. So I've got that one. I just recorded a new CD a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, man, I gotta just put stuff out on. But yeah, I'm getting ready to release the one with Mark Giuliano and Mike Stern.
Yo, 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 this is Craig Gash. Subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on the Instagram, the YouTube.
Okay.
Leave us a comment.
I just stubbed my toe!
All right. That was my talk with Tony Gray. I want to bring specific attention to something that he mentioned that we kind of hopped off of real quick, but I wanted to circle back to it because I did continue to look it up, and it was Oliver Sacks' book. Right, Oliver Sacks. The book is called Music Ophelia. It's written according. These are Oliver's words. This is Oliver's words here. The book Musicophilia is written as an attempt to widen the general population's understanding of music and how it affects, and its effects on the brain. I ordered it. Since I talked to Tony, I have ordered it. I'm waiting for it to show up. I hadn't heard about this book or even this dude until Tony hit me to it. So thank you, Tony, for that. And thanks for being on the podcast. I really like also what he had to say about studying permutations and stuff. Like, that's just one of those things I don't always remember to practice. Like, that's not in the forefront. But also, since my talk with him, I've been going back and checking some of that out. But that's been cool, man. Just learning how to get away with a little bit. You know, like how to turn a little bit into a lot and maximize your practice time, your vocabulary, all those things, permutations. I'm really glad he brought that up in the conversation, because that definitely impacted my practice time. That's about all I got for this one. That's all I got. I will catch you on the next one, folks, in a minute.